Women deserve to be treated as intelligent participants in their healthcare rather than passive recipients of standardized procedures. We're talking about pap smears, mammograms, feminine hygiene products, skincare chemicals, and synthetic fragrance. I was never informed of these things. I was never informed about what was used on the tools for these screenings. It's a carcinogenic compound that is being used on a tool entering your body. Where is that on the consent forms? The average woman applies multiple personal care products every single day. By the end of one day, a woman may have layered well over 100 chemical compounds onto her skin without ever realizing it. Hello and welcome back to the Gubba Homestead Podcast. I'm Gubba, a first-time homesteader following in the footsteps of my homesteading forebears. I discuss everything from homesteading to prepping and everything in between. Today, we are talking about one of the most protected and rarely challenged areas of modern life, which is women's health. I know a lot about this topic as I am a woman, so make sure to share this with the women in your life and listen so you can help yourself or someone you love, because there are certain things women are simply expected to do without question. Schedule the screening, use the product, trust the label, follow the recommendation, and most of the time, women are given a quick summary of benefits, but almost never the deeper story behind the risks, ingredients, long-term concerns, or industry conflicts shaping those recommendations. And that is what this episode is about. Because informed consent without full information is not informed consent at all. And before we get into this episode, I want to thank the sponsor of my podcast, which is my small skincare business, Arvati. Arvati began with one towel balm I made for my dad when he was suffering from eczema, and now it has grown into something that helps thousands of people looking for cleaner, truly nourishing skincare. So if you are ever wanting to upgrade your skincare routine and get away from harsh conventional products, you can explore my small batch made towel balms, cleansers, serums, and goat milk soaps at Arvati.com. And now let's get into this episode. Today we are diving deep into five things every woman deserves to understand before blindly trusting the systems, products, and procedures that have become normalized in women's healthcare. We are talking about pap smears, mammograms, feminine hygiene products, skincare chemicals, and synthetic fragrance. So think perfumes. And I want to be clear from the beginning, this is not fear-based. This is educational. This is about nuance, transparency, and giving women information they are too often denied. I want to help empower women so they can advocate for themselves, they can decide for themselves, and not give in to the fear if their doctor's office is calling them, saying they need to do a screening, saying they need to do this. This is to help you understand the whole aspect of different procedures that are outlined for women's health. One of those being the pap smear. I am not a doctor. I am just a woman who has researched these things and has made my own choices in regards to my health. So again, you do what is best for you, and you can listen to whatever healthcare professional works for you and your body. Pap smears have become so normalized in women's healthcare that most women never pause to question what is actually happening during that procedure, what materials are involved, or what information is being left out of the conversation. And if you are listening to this and you're like, wow, I've never questioned it, don't feel alone, because most of us don't. I did not for so long because, again, I grew up in the matrix. I didn't question the medical system. If my doctor said to do something or suggested it, I thought, great, they know better. But in reality, later on, I realized I know my body and I can figure out what is best for me. And for many women, the pap smear is introduced as a routine milestone of adulthood, placed on the same checklist as annual exams and blood work, presented with the reassuring language of prevention and standard care. That benefit should not be minimized because many women claim they have found that benefit with the pap smear and it has saved their lives by detecting their cancer. And I will not discredit anyone's experience. Again, I am just here to help women see the whole picture and understand it and be able to advocate. What is often missing, however, is any meaningful discussion about the mechanics behind the procedure itself, especially the materials and sterilization systems involved in tools used during gynecology exams. Women are typically told what the pap smear is looking for, but not what the instruments used to collect those samples may have been exposed to before entering the exam room with you. So the disposable speculums, the cervical brushes, and collection devices are frequently manufactured from plastic polymers that cannot withstand high heat sterilization, which is why many of them are sterilized using ethylene oxide gas. And ethylene oxide is widely used in the medical industry because we are told it is highly effective at penetrating packaging and killing bacteria, viruses, and fungi on delicate heat-sensitive instruments. Yet, ethylene oxide is not a benign substance. It has been classified by the Environmental Protection Agency, the World Health Organization, and multiple other agencies as a carcinogen due to its established links to cancer in occupational exposure settings. And that distinction matters. I didn't know that. The fact that ethylene oxide is used in sterilization does not automatically make every sterilized medical device dangerous, right? But it does raise a serious question about the disclosure. Women are almost never informed whether the instruments used in their pap smear were sterilized using ethylene oxide, what residual levels may remain after sterilization, and how those levels are tested, or what safety thresholds regulators deem acceptable. Those thresholds exist, but they are determined by regulatory risk models that most patients never see, never hear explained, and are never invited to question. So in any other setting, if a known carcinogenic compound were involved anywhere in the chain of exposure to an internal medical procedure, most people would assume that fact would be at least mentioned in the consent process. And the discussion becomes even more layered when one looks beyond the instrument itself and into the downstream consequences of abnormal findings. So pap smears are screening tools, not diagnostic tools, which means they identify suspicious cellular changes that may require further investigation. The problem is that screening tests inevitably create gray areas, so mild abnormalities can resolve spontaneously, especially in younger women, because many cervical cell changes can clear up naturally without intervention. Yet, once an abnormal pap result enters a medical chart, it can trigger a cascade of follow-up procedures. So these interventions are not insignificant. Again, speaking from my own experience, I was never informed of these things. I was never informed about what was used on the tools for these screenings. I was never told if ethylene oxide was used. And think about how crazy that is. It's a carcinogenic compound that is being used on a tool entering your body. Where is that on the consent forms? And then with the downstream effects that an abnormal pap smear can cause, for example, removing abnormal cervical tissue using a heated wire loop. And women need to understand that we are told this has a benefit, but they are not consequence-free. So research has shown associations between cervical excisional procedures and increased risks of cervical insufficiency, preterm birth, and complications in future pregnancies, depending on how much tissue is removed. For women who are never told that possibility before agreeing to the follow-up treatment, the emotional impact can be profound. Like, think about that. The language surrounding abnormal pap results is often clinical and detached. Yet for the women receiving the phone call, it may mean days or weeks of fear and anxiety and uncertainty before she even knows whether the abnormality is truly dangerous. And when you are living in fear and you have that stress, that cortisol is not going to be good for your body. It's going to stress your entire system out. And when your body's operating under stress, you're going to have decreased sleep. You're going to have a mind, at least for me, that is going a million miles an hour. So how are you going to be able to focus day to day if you got this scary phone call and you know nothing about what is coming down the pipes? This is why you need to be informed on what this cascade looks like, on what this procedure is about, what it's doing, how it works. True informed consent requires that we as women understand not only the benefit they tell us that pap smears can catch dangerous changes early, but also the limitations, the false positive rates, the potential for overtreatment, the materials used in the exam, and the implications of each subsequent intervention. It requires physicians to explain not simply that a pap smear is recommended, but why, how often, under what circumstances, and with what trade-offs. Women are still treated under broad, one-size-fits-all protocols that fail to acknowledge that personalized medicine should apply to preventative care as much as it does to treatment. That's just where we are at with medicine, sadly. And the point is that women deserve to be treated as intelligent participants in their healthcare rather than passive recipients of standardized procedures. A woman has every right to ask what materials are being used, how instruments are sterilized, whether there's alternatives that exist, what the actual risk profile is, what the false positive rate may be, and what the long-term implications are if an abnormal result leads to intervention. Some would say the pap smears remain a valuable tool in women's health, but value does not excuse the lack of information. Preventative medicine should never rely on blind trust alone. A procedure can be beneficial and still deserve scrutiny. I'm just here to give you the big picture. And that is the conversation women should have been invited into all along. In my personal experience, thinking back on my doctor's visits, I was never invited into those conversations. And if I was going to go back, I would want a doctor who would have an open dialogue with me. I wouldn't want one that gets offended if I ask them a question, who has an ego and doesn't want to discuss with me. I would want someone who would be open to what I have to say, and I would be open to what they have to say. And again, you can do whatever is best for you. And along with the pap smear, we have mammograms. Mammograms occupy a uniquely protected space in modern women's healthcare, largely because they are framed not merely as a screening option, but as a moral obligation. So for decades, public health messaging has conditioned women to associate getting a mammogram with responsibility, vigilance, and survival. The narrative is simple and emotionally powerful. So early detection saves lives. Therefore, routine mammograms are presented as an unquestionable good. And there is truth to that. Again, I'm not going to discredit anybody's experience. Whatever you have experienced and it's been good for you, that is great. Whether it has helped detect something early or reduce disease progression and improve your long-term outcomes, I'm here for it. For certain women, mammograms have absolutely been life-saving. And again, I will never discredit that. But what is often absent from the public conversation is a serious, balanced examination of the physical, biological and diagnostic complexities surrounding the mammogram itself. At its core, the mammogram is a radiologic imaging technique that requires the breasts to be compressed between two rigid plates in order to flatten the tissue and obtain clear X-ray images. So the reason for compression is practical, right? From an imaging standpoint, you know, flattening reduces tissue overlap, improves image clarity, and lowers the radiation dose required to produce diagnostic images. That is the official rationale. Yet what is presented as a technical necessity can feel for many women physically invasive and deeply uncomfortable and painful. These are not rare complaints. They are one of the most common experiences women report after the mammogram, and especially pain. Pain is minimized as though discomfort is an inconsequential trade-off rather than a legitimate factor worthy of medical discussion. The more controversial question, however, is whether the compression itself can create mechanical stress on vulnerable breast tissue in ways that deserve more scrutiny than they currently receive. Some clinicians and critics have raised concerns that forceful compression may rupture fluid-filled cysts, aggravate inflamed tissue, compress sensitive lymphatic pathways, or traumatize already compressed breast structures. In women with fibrocystic changes where breast tissue may already contain multiple painful nodules or cystic pockets, the concern is not theoretical from the patient perspective. Many women report post-mammogram soreness lasting hours or days, and in some cases describe inflammatory flare-ups after imaging. Again, this is not discussed enough. There's not that informed consent. And there's that aspect of pain, at least from my experience in the doctor's office and with friends and family, I feel like women are not taken as seriously when it comes to pain. So then you have this procedure where a lot of women are reporting pain, but they're just supposed to brush it off for a moral obligation. It is important to know the positive benefits, but also if there are negative aspects to whatever you are receiving. Mainstream radiology organizations maintain that mammograms are generally safe and that compression-related harm is minimal. Yet the reality is that very little public-facing discussion explores whether repeated annual mechanical compression of delicate tissue has subtle long-term implications, particularly in women whose breasts are already structurally vulnerable. When a screening test requires crushing living tissue between metal plates, women deserve more than a slogan and a pink ribbon. They deserve a full explanation of the trade-offs. That statement may sound provocative, but it points to a deeper issue. Medicine often frames discomfort as acceptable without fully exploring whether all patients bear that burden equally. Then there's the radiation question, which is rarely discussed with nuance. Mammograms use low-dose ionizing radiation, and while each individual scan exposes a woman to only a small amount, radiation exposure is cumulative over a lifetime. So a single mammogram may be considered low risk, but a woman who begins annual screenings in her 40s and continues into her 70s may accumulate decades of repeated ionizing exposure concentrated in radiosensitive breast tissue. We're not told that. Radiologists emphasize that the benefits outweigh the risks in most screening populations, and that statement may be true in many cases, but the phrase low dose should never be mistaken for no consequence. Ionizing radiation, by definition, has the ability to alter cellular DNA. The risk may be statistically small, but it is not non-existent, and women deserve to understand that distinction. attention rather than being reassured with vague language that glosses over the biological reality of it. Another major issue in mammograms that is profoundly under-discussed is overdiagnosis. Overdiagnosis occurs when mammograms detect abnormalities that technically meet criteria for cancer or precancer, but would never have become life-threatening during a woman's lifetime. So this is one of the most difficult realities in cancer screening, because once an abnormality is found, neither patient nor physician can easily predict with certainty which lesions will progress aggressively and which may remain harmless. So as a result, women may undergo biopsies, lumpectomies, mastectomies, radiation, or hormonal therapies for lesions that might have never harmed them. And this creates a paradox in the breast screening medicine. Some women are saved by early detection, while others are subjected to invasive treatment for findings that may never have posed real danger. And that distinction matters enormously because overtreatment is not benign. Biopsies carry procedural risks, surgeries alter tissue permanently, and radiation has systemic effects. Hormonal therapies may create years of side effects, including bone loss, fatigue, hot flashes, cardiovascular strain, and emotional stress. Yet, the public narrative around mammograms rarely acknowledges this complexity. Screening campaigns tend to emphasize emotional urgency rather than diagnostic nuance, leaving women with the impression that every detected abnormality represents an imminent life-threatening emergency, when in reality, breast pathology is often far more complicated. Again, the benefit we are told they have does not erase the complexity of them. A woman should never be pressured into a mammogram through fear alone, nor should she be shamed for asking hard questions about the compression, trauma, radiation, false positives, dense tissue limitations, or if there are alternative imaging options. The real issue is not whether mammograms are good or bad. The real issue is whether women are being given full spectrum information before they agree to them. I never was, because true preventative care is not built on blind compliance. It is built on knowledge, context, transparency, and the right of every woman to make medical decisions with her eyes fully open. And you don't even have to be in the medical setting to be making better choices. You can also be making better choices at the store when it comes to skincare, feminine hygiene products, and perfumes. They really think they got us, but I'm going to break it all down for you so you know what you're getting into the next time you're at the store. So we just discussed some things that go on in medical settings with different procedures. And now I want to transition into the store aspect, because when you walk into a store, you are hit with the perfume department and the makeup department and all this stuff for vanity, right? Well, they are coming for you through those ingredients. Modern skincare is marketed as self-care, wellness, beauty, confidence, anti-aging, and empowerment. Yet behind the polished packaging and luxury branding lies an industry built on chemical complexity that most women are never taught how to decode. The average woman applies multiple personal care products every single day. So the cleanser, the toner, the moisturizer, serum, sunscreen, makeup, primer, foundation, body lotion, deodorant, shampoo, conditioner, styling creams, perfumes, lip products, and hand creams, often before leaving the house in the morning. So by the end of one day, a woman may have layered well over 100 chemical compounds onto her skin without ever realizing it. And what makes this especially significant is that the skin is not an inert wrapper. Skin is a living organ, and many chemical compounds enter through the skin, especially when applied repeatedly on thin skin, over large surface areas, or in formulations specifically designed to enhance the penetration. And this is where endocrine disrupting chemicals enter the conversation. Many conventional skincare and cosmetic products contain ingredients that have raised concerns in hormone and fertility research, including parabens, phthalates, formaldehyde-releasing preservatives, oxybenzone, and synthetic fragrance blends. So, for example, parabens are widely used preservatives because they prevent microbial contamination and extend shelf life, but their structural similarity to estrogen has made them extremely controversial. Studies have demonstrated that parabens can exhibit weak estrogenic activity, meaning they may mimic estrogen behavior in the body under certain conditions. Parabens have also been detected in human breast tissue samples, which has intensified the public concern for them. And that makes me personally concerned. I would never use a product with them. I try to beware of ingredients that are going to affect my hormones. And the larger issue, however, is not any one chemical in isolation. The real concern is the cumulative burden. And I speak about this all the time online because same thing goes with eating food as well. And that's why it drives me nuts when people say everything in moderation. No, a poison is still a poison in moderation. A woman may use a moisturizer with parabens, sunscreen with oxybenzone, perfume containing phthalates, and shampoo with fragrance compounds all before breakfast. And we have these regulatory systems that often assess safety ingredient by ingredient, yet the female body is not exposed ingredient by ingredient. It experiences them as layered mixtures interacting simultaneously in complex biological systems. Your skincare shelf may be the most overlooked endocrine experiment in your home, and most women have no idea they are participating in it every morning. That is precisely why ingredient literacy matters. For women dealing with infertility, irregular cycles, estrogen dominance, PCOS, thyroid dysfunction, unexplained migraines, chronic inflammation, or persistent hormonal imbalance, environmental toxic load may be one overlooked contributing factor among many. So this is deeply personal to me, and it is part of why I created Arvati. When I started Arvati, my goal was not simply to make skincare products. It was to strip skincare back to formulations rooted in nourishment rather than chemical overload. I wanted products built around ingredients the skin recognizes and can work with rather than synthetic cocktails. Because real skincare should strengthen the skin barrier, support repair, replenish lipids, and protect without forcing women to absorb unnecessary synthetic additives disguised as sophistication. Luxury has convinced women that more ingredients mean better skincare, and often the opposite is true. Sometimes the most protective skincare is the simplest. The formulations with fewer unnecessary chemicals, fewer endocrine disruptors, fewer hidden fragrance blends, and fewer compounds that the body must process without ever having asked for them. Choosing cleaner skincare is not a trend. It is a long-term investment in reducing unnecessary chemical burden in a world already saturated with exposure. I talk about all of these products that women use before leaving the house and how I said they are exposed to hundreds of chemicals, these synthetic chemicals, before even eating their first bite of breakfast. Then picture their systems when they go out into the world and then they're exposed to everybody's perfumes and they're exposed to the lines in the sky. So our bodies are constantly trying to regulate. So if you can help your body by taking off one toxic load of whatever product that may be, your body's going to say, Thank you. I can process the other stuff. I now have time for the other stuff and I am running much smoother. That has been my experience. I've noticed when I've stripped away the toxic goop in my life, layer by layer, I feel that my body has developed this inner connection with health and it's been able to regulate itself better because I am actively choosing systems that support it instead of systems that are making it harder to run. And again, as women, we are constantly under attack. If you think about, we have talked about these routine medical procedures that we are told to do for whatever reason. Again, do what is best for you. And then our skincare, which you go to the store and you have aisles just loaded with all kinds of just chemical sludge. But then think about monthly when we have our cycles and you also go to the store and there's aisles of products to use. And I feel like not many women understand these products that they are using. I didn't for a long time until I looked into them. Feminine hygiene products often include chlorine, bleached rayon or cotton fibers, synthetic fragrance blends, adhesives used in pad backings, polyethylene plastic layers, chemical gels, petroleum-derived liners, dyes, and preservative agents. So while each of these ingredients may individually fall within regulatory safety limits, what remains poorly understood is the cumulative burden of repeated use over decades. One of the most debated issues is chlorine bleaching. Many tampons and pads are processed using bleaching methods that historically raised concerns over dioxin byproducts. Dioxins are persistent environmental pollutants that have been studied for links to endocrine disruption, reproductive toxicity, immune dysfunction, and being a carcinogen at certain exposure levels. And these are the products we are using in our bodies. Toxicology often evaluates substances in singular control conditions, yet women do not live in laboratories. They live in cumulative chemical environments. So a woman may use tampons or pads for 5 days every month for 40 years while simultaneously being exposed to endocrine disrupting compounds from, again, cosmetics, food, the food packaging, plastics, detergents, and air fresheners even. The interaction of those layered exposures is one of the least understood aspects of women's health. Like, it's so crazy to me, just a chemical cocktail we're constantly surrounded by. The feminine hygiene market has in many ways normalized chemical interference in one of the body's most self-regulating systems. So healthier alternatives exist, but they are often under-promoted because they are less profitable than reoccurring scented disposable products. So you have unscented organic cotton tampons and pads reduce unnecessary fragrance exposure. You have medical grade silicone menstrual cups, which can help eliminate repeated fiber contact and reduce waste. You have reusable cloth pads, which avoid the plastic layers and adhesives. Women deserve to know that much of what is sold as feminine freshness or hygiene is not medically necessary. It is branding layered over chemical exposure. And when something touches one of the most permeable tissues in the body month after month for decades, good enough ingredient standards are not good enough. We have fragrance in our feminine care products marketed to us, but I feel like we also grew up on the idea that we need perfume to smell good. So just so you know, fragrance is toxic, whether it's in our feminine hygiene products or whether it's that synthetic fragrance that we are spraying on as perfume. When I was younger, I constantly, every day, was wearing perfume. I'd spray it on my wrists and my neck. And just thinking about that is crazy. I haven't used perfume in forever. I'm sure there's some really great naturally made ones, but I just use my tallow now and it smells great. But thinking about how I was spraying those chemicals on my body in sensitive areas And then going about my day while my body is trying to process these chemicals and I'm trying to work and I'm trying to study or do whatever, like my body was being bogged down. And I seriously would never wear perfume again. And that is not saying that I constantly smell bad. I feel like there is this thing in society that if you're not wearing perfume or you're not wearing cologne, you smell bad. I personally despise going out and being hit with a cloud of perfume or cologne. And it's like, why am I being forced to smell all of these chemicals? But it's crazy that the market, the world that we live in, actually has that fragrance in our feminine hygiene care where it is going into a sensitive area. And I truly believe that they know this and they know the side effects, the potential side effects of what this can do to our bodies. But then they are also marketing, oh, well, to smell good, you need all of these chemicals. And if there is one ingredient category that may be the most underestimated, underregulated, and misunderstood in women's health, it is synthetic fragrance. Few consumers realize how deeply fragrance has infiltrated daily life because it no longer exists only in perfume bottles. It is embedded into lotions, shampoos, detergents, dryer sheets, deodorants, candles, cosmetics, facial creams, baby wipes, again, feminine products, household cleaners, hand soaps, hairsprays, and even products marketed as unscented may still contain those fragrance compounds. You need to read the labels. It's so crazy to me, just think back in the days when I would keep a can of Febreze and spray it to freshen up my house. Oh, that is so just cringe to me. I never want to smell that again. When I go into stores and I walk by the laundry detergent aisle or the fragrance aisle, I get a headache now because my body has detoxed from that. And so now my body smells those toxins. It can't handle it. Some may say that is because my body's weak now. I say I am very happy with where my body's at. It is detoxed. And to think, I used to like to go to the laundry department or the aisles at the stores and smell the laundry softeners. I'd go from can to can. When I was younger, I loved smelling the scents. And the word fragrance sounds harmless and almost elegant, but on an ingredient label, it is often one of the least transparent terms in the entire product. Under trade secret protections, manufacturers are legally permitted to list fragrance as a single umbrella term while concealing dozens or hundreds of proprietary chemicals contained within that blend. So consumers are rarely told which specific compounds are included, even when some of them may be allergens, respiratory irritants, endocrine disruptors, or compounds linked to reproductive toxicity. And we wonder why there's fertility issues. This means a single word on a label may hide phthalates, volatile organic compounds, aldehydes, synthetic musks, benzene derivatives, solvents, and sensitizing preservatives, all without itemized disclosure. And honestly, once you realize this, you're going to be reading the labels. And when you see fragrance, like, put that down, or at least I do. I would never get something that just has fragrance because, like I said, that's an umbrella term. And there could be something that is going to harm my body and they haven't put out the studies. There hasn't been enough complaints on it yet. It's just so toxic. I really despise how the system operates like this in secret. And then real people are being harmed. I know so many women who are struggling with fertility. And when I started going through our food system and I started going through the cosmetic system, the feminine hygiene, the perfume, all of this, it became crystal clear to me why I think there are so many fertility issues. The innocent word fragrance may be the most chemically deceptive label in your home. And women are marinating in it from morning until night. And what makes fragrance uniquely problematic is that exposure is nearly impossible to avoid unless a woman makes deliberate lifestyle changes. A woman may avoid perfume personally and still be exposed through scented laundry detergent on clothing, fragranced office air fresheners, candles in public buildings, perfumes worn by others, salon products, and fragrance cleaning chemicals used in shared environments. It's so crazy. Like, we can't get away from it. And because hormone systems operate on this delicate signaling pathway, even low dose repeated exposure may matter more than people realize. The endocrine system is not designed to process synthetic fragrance chemicals as biologically meaningful inputs, yet many fragrance compounds, they mimic or block or interfere with hormone signaling in ways researchers are still unraveling. Like, why take that risk? So women are particularly vulnerable because of our hormonal rhythms. They're central to reproductive health, fertility, menstrual cycles, thyroid regulation, our mood balance, metabolic stability, and pregnancy outcomes. So even subtle disruption in endocrine communication can create cascading effects over time. And this is why unscented products should not be seen as plain, dull, or inferior. Unscented often means fewer hidden chemicals, fewer undisclosed phthalates, fewer respiratory irritants, and fewer unnecessary exposures layered into daily life. Natural scent from whole essential oils, when used carefully and transparently disclosed, is not the same as synthetic fragrance blends engineered in laboratories from undisclosed derivatives. Fragrance has been sold to women as beauty, femininity, comfort, and luxury. But behind that marketing language lies one of the most chemically opaque industries in modern consumer life. And the more women understand that, the more power they regain over what they allow into their homes, onto their skin, and into their bodies. Again, stepping back and just looking at the entirety of this system, being a woman and up against the system really is crazy. But once you listen to this podcast, once you start reading those ingredients, once you understand the benefits and the potential negatives of procedures, you can start to make better informed decisions. You're going to go to the store. You're going to walk down the feminine hygiene aisle. You're going to look at the box. You are going to see what ingredients are used. You're going to know that fragrance is an umbrella term. There could be so many toxins under the ingredient fragrance. You're going to throw out your toxic candles and get beeswax candles. You will stop using detergent that is loaded with toxic ingredients. That's such an easy thing. Think about the laundry detergent you use. I just use vinegar and a few drops of essential oils. My clothes are clean. They smell good. And again, man, if I smell laundry detergents, I get an immediate headache. That's my body telling me something. That's my body telling me something is off. But since we're little and we grow up in these toxic environments, our body just gets used to it. But once you detox, your body will tell you. I hope this episode has opened your eyes to the world of women's health and will lead you to asking more questions and to learn more, or to not be afraid to advocate for yourself. I appreciate you so much for listening. Let me know if you found this helpful. You can find me on my website, which is gubbahomestead.com. And I hope you have a wonderful day, and I will see you next time.